This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. what's our situation? So I was in Europe last week. I gave this class on refugees in St. Petersburg, in Stockholm, and in Budapest, in Hungary.
Wow. In English?
Well, that was part of the problem with the class that we won't experience tonight. But yes, I gave it in English. Mm-hmm. They speak English very well in two of the three countries.
Stockholm, probably.
In Stockholm, they speak beautiful English. And Budapest was good, and Russia was less good, but that wasn't what made it so interesting. What made it so interesting was teaching to different population, to different cultures, and the very different approaches that they bring with them to the issue, whatever the issue is. So, to this issue in particular, I think, because it's impacting people so acutely. In Stockholm, I had people from about 20 different countries in the class, including Greece and Serbia, Croatia. And those people also have very unique perspectives on the problems of, some people have been refugees themselves. And it was interesting to think about it. And so it's been quite interesting for me, this class. And it's convenient for me to be teaching it now. The title of the class is Kol Dichvin Yetevi Echol. Nobody knew where that came from. I bet here people know where that comes from.
Surely you are a harakasoy.
Vicky's a regular. Shoshan is a regular at our Seder table, where my daughter likes to go off on this statement. Yes, she does. Let's see. I like to start off with a lot of. And as I said, it depends on your perspective. If you come from Hungary and you come from Sweden, or you come from Serbia, you'll have a different perspective on this issue, and it really depends on where you're coming from. And so I like to start the class in a few different places. And I used to hand them out at random, but I felt that it got to be a little bit too much, so I broke them into three different groups of beginnings. And I think we'll start them in a logical order. We'll start with you, Sean.
Present your card. Thierry is a Sudanese 10-year-old hiding in the brush while his family was killed.
Boy, this is a true story. When I went as part of my social justice class during the year, so every year since the first, we've been going to South Tel Aviv and focusing on this issue and meeting with refugees. One year, we heard from this young man who was 19 now and had earlier endured really hearing his family be slaughtered. And incidentally, it was a long path for him to get to Israel through several adoptive families before somebody helped him sneak over the border, where he was shot in the tush on the way across the border. But after he got shot by the Egyptian army on the border, they did bring him to a hospital in Israel and then put him in a boarding school where he learned Hebrew and graduated high school and was considering conversion because he wanted to join the army. When you hear that story, you have a natural reaction, which is, what's your natural reaction when you hear that story?
Learning conversion, he asked him to the country.
Oh, he'll for for sure be an essay. Wait, compassion, you have to feel compassion.
I worry that he'll somehow end up getting put back on the Egyptian border and have to decide what he does, because the orders for handling refugees changed between the time he was admitted and cared for in Israel and the time he was considering army.
Yes, for sure.
There is a movie I saw very recently, a documentary that was done about, there's a group in Zichron-Yakov.
Hotline?
Hmm?
Which movie did you see?
Well, it was a documentary by Sam Zichron-Yakov a few weeks ago, and it was sponsored by a group from Zichron that goes to South Tel Aviv and works with the African immigrants, refugees, whatever. And this was about, it followed various South Sudanese families. And they all had jobs. These were families, not individuals. And one girl already was in Mechina and was going to go in the army, and all the families were forced to leave. And this was when Derry came out with, like, some really horribly written, not Derry, the other guy who took over for him.
Ishai.
Yeah, so really awful racist things. It was really depressing. There was an eye-opener. I hadn't realized that. I thought they were offered to go back. I didn't realize that they were forced to go back. And many have died who have gone back.
The South Sudanese. Yeah, it's very complex. Okay, so when I hear the story of Deary, I'm reminded of the Torah source number 3. Shoshana, you want to read that one?
Sure. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe in the Nile. While her maidens walked along the Nile, she spied a basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to fetch it. When she opened it, she saw that it was a child, a boy crying. She took pity on it and said, "This must be a Hebrew child."
So, why does she save Moshe?
She had compassion.
She had compassion. The
and guts.
And guts.
Yeah.
Compassion and guts, two things. Yes, that. Okay, so let's start with the compassion. In the context of compassion, the Midrash picks up on Hine Nar Boche. Behold, the boy is crying. Nar Boche. And they pick up on this language, Nar and Boche, because Nar seems to be, you know, a youth. Some sort of adolescent child, and he's a little boy in a basket. So the Midrash says that God, the angel Gabriel came down, spanked him on the butt because he was acting like a real nar. He was being brave and he wasn't crying, probably like Deary in the brush, you know, trying to be brave for his life, and he got a smack on the butt to help him cry, because it was that cry that allowed Bat Paro to open up her heart. And there's something about hearing the cry that's very powerful. You know, that the rabbis are aware of this, the humanity of hearing the cry, and what does that mean? And so she hears the cry. And let's focus on which is a great Jewish and the virtue, a virtue that is emulation of a Kaddish Baruch Hu. But she also has this tremendous bravery, and the rabbis really focus on her name is Bat Paro. She has no name, but then she's given a name. Later on, within the Tanakh, in the Book of Chronicles, she gets a name. You know what it is? You probably know. It's Batya. Look in the... you can see in Chronicles 4:18, his wife, Yehudit, bore Jared, father of Gedor, Hever, the father of Socho, Yukutiel, the father of Zanoach. These were the sons of Bitya, Bat Paro, who married. Okay, all of these are names in the first, are different names of Moshe, as the Midrash understands it. Hey, Miriam, thanks for making it. So obviously we see Batya and Bitya is the same as Batya and Bat Paro. She used to be nameless and have the name of Paro. And then she basically gets adopted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu and gets that name. The rabbis focus on, like, they imagine her. It says that she's with these amot. She's got these handmaidens with her. Yes, ma'am. And the rabbis, I really like this midrash. Gary, you want to read it? Number 5. Yeah.
To wash on the Nile, to clean herself from the disgust idols of her father's house.
Okay, I'm skipping that for now. Keep going.
And her maidens go. Rabbi Yochanan said, go means die. And similarly, it says, I'm going to die.
Right, he says, so we have a verse where she says, Hine anochi holech lamut. I'm going to die. So apparently holech is equivalent to dying, so that means that they died. Explain. Keep going, Gary.
The maiden said to her, the way of the world is that even if the entire world ignores the decree of the king, his family obeys it, and you are disobeying your father's command?
Okay, so this is like they put in the... to feel the courage, which you guys identified right away, they put these amot here, speaking to her, saying, are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? You are the daughter of the king himself. Everyone can ignore the government. Okay, this is easy to understand if you live in Russia. Everyone can ignore the government, but you, you have to keep the law of the law of the king. You, what are you thinking? Keep going.
Immediately, the angel Gabriel came and pounded them to the ground.
Okay, God kills the, Gabriel kills the maiden because she wants to make sure that Bitya keeps that courage going. Who would be able to keep that courage going in that very difficult situation? Okay, I'm going to leave the rest of this, but just to feel the power of her courage. In order to further accentuate her courage, they also marry her off. Do you know who they marry her off to? Anybody know who her husband is? I mean, it says here married. Who married. But married also is supposed to be a code name. It's Kalev Ben Yefuna. Who is Kalev Ben Yefuna? I mean, what does he do and why is he an appropriate...
He was one of the two spies who came back with a favorable report.
Yafes, so he's a good spy. So why does it make sense that he should marry Bitya? They're both good. What do they both have in common? They're both good, and they have something in common.
They observe correctly.
They go against the tide.
They go against the tide. Courage, mm-hmm. Right? It comes back to the courage, but it's not just courage. It's courage and ability to... We're so natural to under... Usually when I'll tell my kids you're doing something, but is that the right thing to do? They'll say, everybody's doing it. a lot of people do it, so it must be okay. We can't help it. Our moral codes are naturally dictated by what's we think is normal around us. And Bitya and Kalev have the ability to step out and rebel against what's going on around them. And that is the beginning. David Blumenthal writes about this as the basics of ethical training. And I like, after coming back from Europe, I can really feel it even more poignantly. Is if you really want to teach people to be ethical, you have to teach them to be willing to stand up against the powers. I'm from Washington, D.C., so I think I was raised to think, you know, like the government knows what they're doing. I know, it's crazy, but it stuck with me for a long time. If it's the law, it must be just. And of course, and here you see that the Lohi, that's not the case at all. The magic of being God's daughter is two. To be God's daughter, you have to, one, be able to hear the cry, and two, be able to think for yourself. think for yourself and be able to defy the powers that be. Okay, so that's what I, yes, Lauren.
I know this is a midrash, but I mean, how would an Egyptian princess be able to marry an Israelite slave? Right?
Right, in halacha, you mean?
No.
She can,
logically.
This logic does not come into this story. Because,
okay.
Right, she is the mother of Moshe. Moshe is the senior of Kalev. The chronology doesn't work at all. It's totally symbolic.
Yeah, okay.
Right,
so
it
ends, I take it literally. It's just...
I mean, I think you're meant to take it fantastically literally, like it's a great magical story.
Gotcha.
But it's not, but you need a lot of suspended disbelief in order to in order for it to be true. Because she's much older than, she's old enough to be Moshe's mother, and Moshe's 80, and Kalev is a spy.
Younger.
Yeah, so it's like a huge, it doesn't make sense.
South American fiction. Magical reality.
Exactly. Magical realism. That's what it is. Sort of at most. But because it's all about the symbol. It's the symbol of what the two of them, I'm interested in how, it's a fantastical story that comes to tell you, wow, think about who is Kalev ben Yefune, and think about who is Batya, and think about how they come together, and isn't that interesting? But all of that comes from starting with Deary. They're, Nicholas Kristof writes about this in the most beautiful way, about the Saving the Darfur Puppy. Have you read that editorial? It's a great editorial about basically if you stand in a grocery store and you say, please give me $10 for Deary, who watched his parents be slaughtered while he was hiding in the brush, they'll give you $10. If you say, please give me $10 for 1,000 dearies who were hiding in the brush, they won't give you. The chances of them giving you are much slimmer. So there's a certain, the ability to hear, to feel compassion on a single individual is very strong amongst humans, and in a beautiful way. And that's a great way to approach the story. And that's the way we usually, a good starting place in my class. And it can be really, really compelling to meet those people. In the beginning years, by the way, it was really beautiful. We would, the first refugees that we met with in 2000, I forgot what year, did you meet with refugees? Or we did, the first years, they had wonderful things to say about the state of Israel. And my students, of course, they're like, they're young Americans in their 20s, and they grew up with race as in the forefront of their mind of issues. And they would ask questions like, but tell me about the racism that you experienced here, or tell me about the difficult times you had here. And they would, and the refugees would say, you can't get me to say anything bad. When I crossed the Israeli border and I was picked up by the soldier, it was the first time that I saw a soldier that he didn't kick me. That they would,
They got water and blankets. The soldiers were carrying water and blankets for refugees. I remember what it was saying.
That was in the beginning. there's another beginning to the story that we'll get to. Before we get to... Yeah, okay, so let's go to that beginning, which is yours, I think. Good.
First one?
Yeah.
Sudan.
Just read them all.
Sudan, a war-torn ethnic cleansing.
With
37 million people.
Yeah, there were 37 million people in Sudan.
Ah, and 6.6 million refugees.
Of those 37 million, at the rating of the time of this card, there were close to 7 million refugees. Okay, go ahead, read the next card.
52,000 illegal infiltrators looking for good jobs, any jobs, can I have a sight of that? Because
yeah, you can. Well,
why did this was it the guy from Shas, who's supposedly a God-fearing person?
Yeah.
Why did he had a monetary incentive not to allow them to work, because we import labor from Thailand, etc., etc., through Kablanin, and the Kablanin pay off Shas, Likud, the political parties, and for money. And I worked it out. It was something like $300 million a year, because they get like 10% of everything. So for monetary reasons, I mean, logically you could say, let them have the jobs they're here, and okay, import less Thai people. But I don't want to be against the Thai.
I don't think that's the only thing motivating Elisha either. I think there's a lot
of things. There might be something else as well, but that helps.
Okay, well, let's talk about
8.2 million Israelis, 6 million Jews, 350,000 others, and 1.7 million.
Because it was confusing, right? There's 1.7 million Arabs of the 8 million residents, citizens, yes.
Pharaoh said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us."
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so those cards, what do they all have in common? That's like, that used to be different beginnings, but I think we can group them all together in a single category. What's the category? What?
Numbers.
Numbers. Okay, yeah, let's get more precise. Beyond numbers, I agree with you.
Percentage of refugees as opposed to the
demographic
population.
Fear. It's all about everything. So much in this country runs on demographic fear.
Yeah.
A lot in this country goes around demographic fear, and it's not nothing, right? That you start off with Diri, one refugee. He caught and you bring him a blanket. He calls home his best friend from high school. And people are nice here, and they start to come. And now there's 6.6. Let's say after you let in 52,000 refugees, there's 6 million refugees still left in Sudan.
Just in Sudan.
Most of our refugees are from Eritrea. Okay, which is like the number one worst country in the world. Well, part was until Syria, I suppose. And not to mention the Syrian refugees. There's so many refugees, 15 million refugees in the world. So we have 50 million refugees in the world. See, it gets to be so many that I can't even remember the number. It's just totally overwhelming.
I was going to say, I was going to problematize your first text from Deary, which is, I challenge her courage. She's a person with unlimited resources and no fear of repercussions from the authorities. Mm.
I think it's interesting because when I
so it's easy for her to grab a Hebrew baby and raise it.
I think that's very powerful because I actually think about it when I think about it from the other perspective that if you think about it from our perspective, she's the daughter of God and she changed the course of world history with that courageous act. But from Paro's perspective. Right, like if you think she made a mistake, because she thought she was just being nice to a Narbochet.
Right.
She brought destruction upon her family.
It's been a while, but the movie The Exodus, I think the American wealthy woman who kept trying to rescue the one girl off the ship.
Kitty Freeman, yes.
Right, Kitty kept trying to
rescue. Right.
So she had unlimited resources, and she just wanted to save one. Just one. She couldn't care less that all the rest all died and everything like that. And so there is that tendency, and you can read that into some of that story as well, you know, which is that it, so it's
interesting.
And then when you get into demographics, it becomes difficult. When you get into resources, it really does.
It really becomes different when you, but the thing that really, so yes, there's really a lot of potential refugees, and the minute we were nice to the first ones, it didn't take long between the you went to the good years, right, when the refugees were still saying nice things. Within a few years, the stories were totally different. And they themselves are saying there's too many refugees here. Because they're fighting for the same apartments and the same jobs. And maybe we could manage the problem better and then you wouldn't have that problem. But that was their reaction. Yes.
So if somebody's Jewish and they immigrate here, like from the moment they set foot, however they get here, from the moment they set foot in the land of Israel, they are not considered a refugee. But the truth is, when they left whatever country they were coming from, which isn't even necessarily the country they were born in, they were refugees. And this country absorbed refugees
for, you know, you'd have to have a debate on deciding when to, what year to say everybody who came after this state was a refugee.
Well, the line between refugee and we have to offer open up the UN Charter on refugees and figure out what exactly is a refugee, and then whether that has any halachic standing or not is also complex. But so yes, I agree with you, and then there's a complexity. So we've got and the look, I adopted on purpose the language of the right wing press, which even Haaretz will adopt too when they say infiltrators. But you're actually not an infiltrator if you enter the country as a refugee, because it's not illegal to cross the border without a permit if you're a refugee, but you just have to be able to substantiate that afterwards. Okay, so the demographic fear in our country is real. We are a little country of 8 million people with many more than 8 million refugees out there happy to come. And we are a country which already has its own demographic struggle. I think it would be crazy not to think about it, not to ask demographic problems. But I get so much pause when I read Paro in Source 2 was the first to think about it, right? In Source 2, it said... Gary already really read this. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt. Right? They started off as 70, but the Israelites were fertile and prolific, and they multiplied and increased very greatly, so the land was filled with them. And a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Yosef, and he said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the ground." Okay, besides for the last part of that verse, which is confusing, which is probably in its simple reading, Lashon Segina, it's euphemistic language for "they will drive us out of the land." That's what Rashi says, that's probably the simple reading of the verse. But he invented demographic fear. And the minute we think of him as the father of demographic fear, then we have to think, "I think I better think it out again." Yeah, like you've got two options when you think, "Oh, look, Paro said the same thing that we're saying." What are our two options? Maybe you've got more than two, but I've got two in my mind. What do we do when we say, "Oh, look, we're experiencing the same thing that Paro..." We're thinking the same thing Paro was thinking.
So that's an evil way of thinking, and we should stop it.
Okay, one thing we can think is, that's an evil way of thinking, and we better think it out again.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to be Paro. He is the epitome of evil, mm-hmm. right? And that's not who we are. So if we find ourselves thinking what Paro is thinking in the opening of the book of Exodus, it's this siman that we're thinking incorrectly, and we have to get over ourselves. That's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is, wow, now I understand where Paro was coming from. A lot of people have sat there and said, "Oh, now I understand where Paro is coming from." That's very compelling too. I don't think we should do that. but it is very powerful. It's interesting. I've seen people, yeah, now I get it, where Paro was coming from. That's also just incredibly scary to think about it in that way. So here we've got these two beginnings. Depending on where you start, you are you find yourself sort of approaching the problem in a different way. The last beginning, who's got that last, the last cards, two cards?
25,000 righteous Gentiles, 6 million victims with nowhere to flee. 1976-79, Menachem Begin accepts 300 Vietnamese refugees abandoned at sea with no country willing to admit them.
I love that piece. I was thinking about the boat refugees and the way that Menachem Begin, with all of his courage, stuck it to all the countries, saying, "We're better than you, and we have the courage. We're not going to let other people visit our history upon us." The idea of I mean, that beginning, I think, is you can start from the individual. You can start from demographic fear. You can start from our very unique history, our very special history. And it calls for a different response when we're coming from that perspective. And Bacon had the courage to give that. Well, it was easy to give that response with 300, and a totally different thing to give it with 5,300. But if I wanted to think about special history, so first, obviously, the place to start with that is source number one, which I don't need to tell you guys. Ve'ahavta betzeger ki gerim heit and be'eretz Mitzrayim. Right, okay, you have to love the ger. I think I can bring it's interesting to me to bring together the third approach with the second approach by looking at source number six. Lauren, you want to do it?
There's been talk, Rabbi Eliezer the Great said, why did the Torah warn against the wrongdoing of a stranger in 36, or as others say, 46 places? Because he's at risk of turning bad. What is the meaning of the verse? Thou shalt neither wrong a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. It has been taught, Rabbi Nathan said, do not taunt your neighbor with the blemish you yourself have.
Okay, the last part's easier, right? You can't make friends of strangers because we were strangers. The part that's hard is that Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol says that this, we know this already, they say it, that Gerim Hayitza Be'eretz Mitzrayim is a chorus that applies, that appears in the Torah 36 times, 46 times over and over. It's not so easy to count them up, but you can count. But for sure you understand that it's a refrain that's stated all the time. And the reason he gives is, Mipnei Shesoro Ra, because he's at risk of turning bad. What does that mean?
He'll get back at you.
Yafeh. Okay, Miriam.
Who's the he?
The stranger.
Is it?
Who do you think it is?
It could also be the individual who's doing the oppressor.
Ah, Yafeh. Hmm. Maybe. Okay. Then we want to explain it, because when you
treat the other cruelly, miserably, whatever, it has an impact on you.
That's very interesting. Okay, great. We're going to go back there at the end. I like that reading. Anybody else want to bring a different reading?
I was wondering if bad could not mean bad in character, but bad things can happen to the person. They can become ill. They can starve.
That's a great reading. I think it's for sure true, right? Because they are... I was going to say they're an at-risk population. And what's supposed to be the response to the fact that you're overwhelmed by, look, where I was, a lot of people said, yeah, but they're bad. The refugees come and they pee on the street and they rape the women. There are a lot talking in Sweden about the rapes and the, even more talking about it in Russia, that how difficult the population is and the bad things they're bringing. And to that.
What refugees are in Russia?
No, just that they've heard about
why they don't have refugees in Russia.
Exactly.
Because they have the
stories. Exactly.
But you hear the same thing in America about people who are homeless, but the reality is there are not enough public toilets even for people who aren't homeless. And if you don't provide facilities, where do you want people to be? Plus, I've seen very wealthy, completely drunk people flee to be on the street. I'm sorry.
Gary, are you raising your hand? no one ever does that for me.
I've heard from old conversations with people, yes, but they rape. And it's terrible. If they do, they do. I worked out the rape rates of the immigrants in our country. And it works out that the social group with the highest rape rate in the country
presidents.
It's unfortunately Jewish male Knesset members.
I believe this.
It does definitely seem like that by sort of short looking at the paper. But they said something like, it's just not reported, but we hear about it. All the police say it's not. In any case, what the Gemara here, because you could say a lot of things in response to that, but the response here, I don't think this is the only response. I don't think we have to bring criminals into our country. But I think it's interesting to see this response, which is, yeah, of course the strangers will do bad things because they're an at-risk population. And if you don't take care, so therefore you really have to take care of them. Because if you don't take care of them, then don't be surprised that they pee on the street. And don't be surprised that they rape women because they've gone through terrible traumas. So you have to be extra careful with them because they're already an at-risk population, so we have to be very careful and provide them extra services. What's your name?
Nicola.
What?
Nicola. Just listening. Thank you. This source. I mean, the two questions. One is whether they're bad in the first place, i.e., if they're on the streets and do everything in the first place. Into your country, or because you're going to turn bad because you've oppressed them, which is what the source here is suggesting. I don't know. So don't oppress them because then they can revenge against you, or they're bad in the first place because they're an at-risk and they're pretty unpleasant in the first place. So I'm not sure which of the two. And I suppose the other question in relation to this, you were strange land, is in that with those references in the Torah, who is the stranger then? Does it include your refugees, or is it the sojourners in your land, or is it proselytes, or whatever? And I suppose that particular source has a few questions, i.e., yeah, so don't wrong them because then they will turn bad, or were they bad in the first place? And then who is the stranger, I suppose?
Miriam, you want to try to say something here?
No, I really don't like this read. Because it basically then turns the Jew who was commanded to not do wrong against a stranger into a self-serving, it's better for me if I'm nice to him because otherwise I may get hurt, as opposed to simply saying, it's my command, I am commanded to be generous and nice to the person who is different from me and happens to live under my auspices. Completely two different, completely different points of view.
Mm-hmm. It really is too. I don't have I hear you, and I think that's a very interesting point. I hear your questions. I think they're interesting questions. I don't have an authoritative answer, of course, to your questions. You understand?
Well, the only reason I ask these questions in such depth is because I did a little piece on Mishpatim where it does reference, you know, to love the stranger or to not to oppress the stranger because you were strange in Egypt. And there were different interpretations
of
Maimonides by Soloveitchik on that, which was interesting. And my little piece that I did for our shul, but my rabbi then came back and said, but who is the stranger? And the ger, which I didn't even think of. And then I looked it up after that. So in the last week, which is why I'm asking, otherwise I'd never even ask the questions. But the definition of the stranger, was he, for him, the central issue, ger, which for him wouldn't include necessarily refugees, that it was a proselyte or the soldier. And then I said, well, so we were in Egypt, so what were we then? What
correct.
We were
in
Egypt.
Right.
So we were sojourners. I didn't go into
the what's the Hebrew for sojourners?
Ger.
I think that the simple reading of this verse is for sure non-Jews. And it in other places where they talk about the laws for the ger, there maybe you could talk about ger toshav, but I don't think here that's what's being meant. But look, obviously, if you have a problem with it, you can interpret it away. Meaning one who doesn't want to read this about foreigners will say, oh, it's not talking about non-Jews. But I don't think that's the simple reading, because the simple reading is you were a stranger. So what were you? As you said. So I think that reading is a very difficult reading, even though I'm aware that it's out there.
Some authoritative, some of the commentators do, a number of the strong commentators do seem to interpret it in that narrower way. I only looked it up because you made the point.
Yeah. People, there are some people who interpret it in that narrow way. Okay, this is what I want to do. It's 40. Yes, sir. We've got three different beginnings. Each of the beginnings, if we start with Diri, okay, we start with Bat Paro. So it's obvious that we have to hear the cry. That's what creates us as moral people. That's the... if we start with demographic warfare, so also we feel, well, wait a minute, we don't want to be like Paro. If we start with our special history, so then there's really nothing to discuss. All of these three approaches seem to, as I've set them up, dictate that we have some obligations and we have to do something for these refugees. But the problems are real. It's not, 53,000 refugees is a lot of refugees. It really is a lot of refugees. So, and it's the only reason why there's only 53,000 is because we built a wall in 2011. Those refugees came, all of them, between 2007 and 2011. And had we let, and they were coming by the end at tremendous numbers. Had we let, had we not built the wall, we would have had many, many more. So the question is, what is the appropriate, how do we find a way to deal with the demographic? On the one hand, we don't want to be Paro. On the other hand, the demographic fear is real. What are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to take care of ourselves? So what I think I'd like to do is just assign a few sources for you to do in Kabruta, and then we can come back to them. So let's see. Sources 15... 14, 19, all of these sources, there's lots of sources on the source sheet that are important. There's nothing on here that's not important. But I'm just picking these ones that start to deal with this question of what are we allowed to do? What would be an appropriate response? So why don't you learn in Chavruta for 10 minutes, and then we'll come back together. Start with sources 15, 14, and 19, and then you can always go on to anything else that interests you. I've labeled what they are so that you can see them. Yeah?
The first couple of minutes, I'm kind of curious why you chose African asylum seekers rather than our own citizen minority.
Next week I'm going to do, or next week the topic is... renting our homes to non-Jews, to Arab city, to Arab minorities. Okay, so I took that straight on, and I took, because I picked two different things. One, our obligation to strangers, and then our obligation to citizens. They're to me, they're different questions. So I treated them separately, but there's no question that I didn't pick them instead. I just picked them both. Go on your record, say go. And bring it back together so that you can, so we can end on time. I know everyone likes to end on time. Okay, these are three different approaches to how. What are we going to do about this? How do we set limits? Because we have to set. We can't take in all of the refugees. It's impossible. It's impossible. So the question is, how do we respond to that reality? So the first is this source I'm sure is very familiar to you, which is source 15. We have to take care of our own first. We set up a series of hierarchies here. It's actually, I think... For my purposes, I can do great violence. For the purposes of why I brought the source today, I can do great violence to the source. I think we could spend a long time on this source, and I often teach this source and spend 40 minutes on this source and talking about this, justifying this clause, im kesef tilvet et amivet, and et anie amcha. It's a verbose verse. Too many words. Everyone knows God only uses the minimum number of words that God needs in order to say what God needs to say. And God said, "You're going to loan my people. You're going to loan the poor. You're going to loan with you." So it must be that those extra words are coming to give you a hierarchy, a set of priorities. If you have to choose between my people and the non-Jews, so you're going to choose Jews first. If you're going to choose between the poor and the rich, the poor comes first. That's obvious. What is that? What do they mean when they? What does the Midrash mean when it says that?
It's the marginal utility of money is great.
Yes,
they get happiness if they're $10 to a poor person and $10 to
another. Relative poverty. Okay, so it's perfectly acceptable, a very good use of tzedakah money, to send your poor relative to college. It's an excellent use of your tzedakah money. But if you had to choose between sending your poor relative to college and feeding the poor person on the street, the poor person on the street, that's it. It's all relative poverty. The poor person on the street should come first. So that's ani v'ashir, ani kodem. Even though there's lots of good needs, but comparatively, the guy who needs a scholarship to college is relatively rich. Aniecha v'aniye ircha, aniecha kodmim. You should give priority to your local poor. Your relatives over the people in your town, and if the people of your town take priority over the people who are more distant than you. So the basic principle here, the basic principle of most of the Kalalim is
charity
begins in the home. Okay, start with your concentric circles of poverty and move outwards, and that is a good principle. They make sense for many reasons, okay? But let's just state a few of them. Why isn't this a good principle?
I mean, it's stating that you have an obligation to those closest to you. The only question I would have if it's, I don't know, this politically charged, if it's a group that deems to be poor, that voluntarily makes themselves poor and insists on being poor, and then wants charity, as opposed to, say, refugees who come in and who are poor, and one help them turn their lives around.
Okay, so Tzvi, I hope Tzvi did that last week. I don't know.
Why so many people who are just going to not do anything with them?
Yeah.
And just
I think that question of poverty by choice is a question that deserves a separate treatment. I'm going to put it aside for separate treatment.
I think
it is an interesting class, poverty by choice. Yes. Why should charity start in the home? Okay. Basic obligation. Your first obligation is to take care of your own citizens, your own family. Okay, it's also practically effective. Why is it practically effective?
Because, you don't really want to live in the midst of enormous poverty. If you can help eliminate poverty, you're actually also improving your own lifestyle and that of your children.
It's a great motivator to give tzedakah close to home. Okay, we want the kids in our, we don't want hungry kids in our children's classes because then the teacher wastes all of her time yelling at the hunger, trying to get the attention of the hungry child, and our child doesn't get to study. So of course we benefit, and that motivates us to give more. Furthermore, improves your local economy. Absolutely. You see the results of your work, and that motivates you to give more. Alternatively, you don't see the results of your good work, and then you say, no, forget about it. If you continue to behave that way, I'm not going to give you money. And that's also good, right? Meaning you can keep a little bit of, are you choosing to be poor? If you choose to be poor, I'm going to give to somebody else. Okay, so that if everyone took care of their relatives, if we all took care of our concentric circles, then theoretically everyone would be taken care of. Okay, so that, I get the logic. There's a huge flaw in this source, which is, logically speaking, these hierarchies. What's the major problem with this source?
That the people closest to you might not be the ones with the greatest need.
Yafe. Okay, sometimes the people close to you don't have the greatest need. Sometimes the people, the hierarchies don't all go together. Sometimes your poor relatives live in America or in England or in Oslo. And then what are we supposed to do, right? Which comes first, the poor of Jerusalem or the poor of Oslo? How are we going to figure that out? So we have to, sometimes the Jewish poor are, sometimes the poor in our community are not Jewish poor. Then we said the Jewish poor come first. So these hierarchies don't go together. We have to figure out how to line up the hierarchies. We have to figure out how to balance them against each other. And we have to also figure out how this works precisely. Because if you say the poor of your... if you say the poor Jews come first, or the local poor come first, but and then you don't give any of your... You take care of all of the needs of your family first. Okay, and look, let me tell you, my kids... There's no end to the needs they can think of, okay? All very legitimate tzedakah needs my children have. But they can get a bit excessive, and I would never have any money for the Part A scholarship fund, which is an important need. So the question is, how do you balance that proportionally also? Do they mean that you give all of your money to those circles, or... Okay, so there's a lot of possible answers to this. I'm just throwing them out for now so you can feel the complexity of the source and the nuancedness of the source. Because I just brought the source here to show you that we have an excuse to say, I'm sorry, we can't help because we have to take care of our own poor first. And you're not our own poor. No matter how you slice it, African refugees, all right, so maybe we can... no matter how you slice it, you want to say the African refugees are not our poor. We've got plenty of poor people in this country. Okay, unless you want to slice it with source 17, which is when you become local poor. Okay, when do you become local poor? You don't have to give until they've been here for 12 months. Some people say 30 days, okay, but local poor is, so one argument I might make is, okay, so we can't take in all the African refugees, but the ones that we've taken in already, those are our local poor now, and we can help them.
Yeah, how about letting them work?
They don't even... No, they can work, they can work. They don't have protection. But they don't get prosecuted. Their employers don't get prosecuted. Never mind that. And some people here know that I paid a 10,000 shekel fine for an Eritrean worker that I didn't know was Eritrean. That's distracting. I shouldn't have said that. But the general rule, the Supreme Court ruled that if we accept, the Supreme Court ruled that if we let the if we since we can't deport them and we're not giving them services, we have to let them work because otherwise, how are they supposed to eat? So we have to let them work, and they don't have, the problem is they don't have work permits, but they don't get prosecuted for working, and their employers also don't get prosecuted for working, and therefore they're vulnerable. They're a very vulnerable population because they can eat, but that's why the hotline for migrant workers, the refugees and migrant workers, works a lot on trying to make sure if they need to take care of an employer, they're there to help them. Okay, but the main goal of this source was to show, look, we're allowed to set limits, we're allowed to say we have to take care of our own poor first, and that's how it should be. Now, we can nuance that.
It brings up a really important thing, which is that allocation of resources needs to be done with a lot of conscious thought. And so I can throw out the categories, I can, you know, all of those kinds of things, but it brings up the idea of the fact that it is not unlimited resources, and there are numerous claims on those resources, and we have to come up with what our own, you know, categories and hierarchies are going to be.
It's so crazy because it seems so obvious, doesn't it? But the main policy of our current government is not to have a policy,
right.
Which is absurd. Okay, but one policy they do have is meant to be represented in Source 14. I like Source 14 because it's the subject of my dissertation. But the goal of the thesis of the source is essentially we can punish people not because they deserve it, but because we want to make an example of them. And that's a policy that's been implemented very much in this country, okay, which is jail. Our number one policy is to build this huge facility, Holot. Okay, we've got 3,000 people, refugees in Holot, not because they did any crime. We're not claiming that they transgressed any crime. We're just putting them there basically so that they won't call their relatives and say, come, it's good, and so that we'll be able to wear them down. We actually don't have we basically have Sudanese there and not Eritreans. Why do we have the Sudanese there and not the Eritreans?
Because we can send back the Sudanese, we can't send back the Eritreans.
Exactly. So we think we'll wear them down by making their conditions bad. And they'll give in, and they'll go somewhere else. Okay, so so it's a huge human rights violation.
Yes,
it's ridiculous. It's an absolutely absurd human rights violation. I put sources here about how Jewish relationship to jail. I have a chapter in my dissertation about jail. Jews don't like jail very much. We don't think it's not a good punishment. And call the Chomer, it's not a good thing to do to people who haven't done anything wrong. But in this source, there is a halachic basis upon which you can essentially violate someone's human rights, not because they did anything wrong, but because it's just a defense. I'm not saying we should do it. I'm giving food for thought, okay? And then when I was in Stockholm, so the Eastern Europeans said, well, look, if you're really a refugee, so you're a lot better off in jail than you are in, it's not legal to put you in jail. Look, all of the refugees, unfortunately, we've got, I looked up now, we've got 50 billion displaced persons in the world when I prepared these notes. 50 million displaced persons. That's one out of 140 people, okay, are displaced persons. The countries that have huge numbers of refugees also confine their refugees, even though it's against human rights. It's against the UN Rights Charter. But Nebuch, what are we going to do? You can't expect if they would be totally overrun by refugees. And so they deprive them of their right of freedom, even though it's against the law, because they feel that they have no choice. And so what I'm saying here is there could be room. Maybe you should just name it as what it is instead of calling it a jail, but which is a little bit what we've done by taking it out of Saronim and putting it into Holot. Is to say, okay, we can't help it, but we have to confine you if you're really a refugee. So put it this way, the 6 million Jews who died because they had nowhere to go would have been very happy to sit in Holot, very happy to sit in Holot. If you're really a refugee, so you'll sit in Holot. If you have somewhere else to go and you're just looking for a good job, so you'll think twice about coming to Holot. So since we have a real problem that really is difficult, so that's one possibility of how to deal with it. Okay, third possibility to deal with it is source 19. I like source 19. It's interesting. I like it because this is Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. It's recent. It's Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He is asked the question, because this is the question that happens to us on Facebook every day, right? Is like, I have a friend who needs a heart transplant. Who's going to help him get his heart transplant? Okay, and they come knocking on your door all the time. Please, can you give me money for I need $500,000 for a heart transplant. So look, we have a mitzvah, Al Ta'amod Al Zamer Echa, which is that you can't let someone die. So obviously, when someone comes knocking at your door, it is. Oh, yeah, that's really bad. That's a terrible, terrible mistake. Oh my gosh! great. Yeah, exactly. That makes for a fun class. You have to spend 20% of your money on doing any particular mitzvah. So the minimum, so you would think that to do that mitzvah, you spend 20%. So says the Mincha Shalom, well, surely when someone knocks on your door, you should give him at least 20%. You probably should give him all of your money because it's life or death for that person. But at the very minimum, you should give him 20% of your money. And I don't understand because I look around and I see that people are not doing it. Very few. Have you ever given 20% of your money to somebody who needs a life-saving operation? Never. Okay, none of us have. So he says, I can't figure out what on earth is going on, because it's obvious that you're obligated when someone knocks on your door to give them everything they need up to 20% of what you've got, because you're saving their lives, life or death. And why don't people do this? So he's totally puzzled. He actually thinks, and he doesn't love his own answer, but this is the answer he provides, and maybe this is the way we could, this is a potential solution to the problem, is that everyone thinks they have to do their fair share. Okay? If you're on the edge of a river and you see someone drowning in the river, so you're the only person there, and the entire obligation of saving that person is on you. But if it's in Facebook, there's 5 million users, and everyone has a portion of that obligation, and it's not just my job, okay? So I don't have to do all of it. I have to contribute, but I don't have to do the whole thing. And so I calculate how much I owe, 1/5 millionth of whatever the amount is, and that's how much I give. And then I can release guilt and say, and even though you die because everyone else doesn't contribute their part, I can say, I did my fair share. It's really you that killed them because you didn't give. Okay, and then he says, I don't really like this solution so much, tsarichiyun. Okay, but the idea is, do your fair share. Okay, the reason why he comes up with the solution is because we're totally overwhelmed. It's a real problem. It's interesting. It's the exact opposite problem of, like, we're talking about the individual who's dying and the millions of people who are dying, but the problem is ultimately the same, that we're overwhelming need that we're being faced with all the time. So I think if we transfer this solution onto the refugee problem, then we take the 50 million displaced people, or maybe we only have to worry about there's 7 billion people in the world, 50 million of them are displaced, that's 1 out of every 140, 0.7% of the population are refugees. So our fair share, us 8 million people, our fair share of the refugees is 57,000. Proportionally speaking. And we've got 53,000 here. So we're not doing that bad at all.
So we've got our fair share.
We've got our fair share. So we can say, we've got our fair share. Everyone else, go do your fair share. And then come back and talk to us. Okay? If you want to do it the other way, you could say, maybe there we only have to worry about, maybe there's only 20 million, because most of the displaced people are internally displaced. Maybe we only have to take responsibility for the people who are beyond the border, who have already left their countries and are not internally displaced, in which case we've done way more than our fair share. In which case, we can go like this. We've got these 53,000. These people are, so I've come back to the same thing I started with, right? These are our local poor. They've been here for more than 12 months. This is our fair share. We're doing our fair share. Let's take care of these 53,000, and without guilt, let the rest of the world take care of the others. If they die, the rest of the world has blood on their hands, not us. This is very hard, okay? All of that comes as justification for building the wall, because all of this becomes possible only because we built a wall. Since we built that wall in 2011, basically, there's not really, we don't have a refugee problem anymore. A few have gotten in, but it's nothing significant. But I want to end, I know it's time to end, so I just end with the source that I love to think about, source number 20, about the refugees. So this is about the wall. This country has two basic solutions. One, put them in jail to deter them. Two, build a wall so that they can't come in. Three, leave the ones that are here. Those are the things we're doing. So they used to live... What'd you say?
Seems to be their solution to a lot of their problems.
There are other solutions we could have, which would be creating a support system in the great meaning. We wouldn't have so much of a big problem if they weren't all in South Tel Aviv and we were providing services for them in different places and we could maybe absorb them. It wouldn't be such a big deal. All right, everything's tried to build to that too. In the olden days, people used to live in a courtyard. This is the street. This is the courtyard. These are all houses. And there was another courtyard over here, of course. They had vadbayit. It's topic of Bhava Batra is to worry about Vadbhait. How do we decide? Obviously, everyone has to pay in Vadbhait for the cleaning of the stairs and for that electric light that goes on in the stairwell. Okay, those are things that are non-negotiable. If you don't pay for that, we can put a lien on your house.
Yeah, there are elevators and Hasaka Merkazit, other things as well.
Okay, and then there's other things as well. Hasaka Merkazit and elevators. Now, once you have an elevator, you have to pay for the elevator maintenance. But what if all the neighbors want to put in an elevator and you don't want to put in an elevator? Can your neighbors compel you to contribute to an elevator? That's the question, basically, that's facing Bhava Batra. But they didn't ask it about elevators. They asked it about the gate here. Okay? Here you've got this courtyard, and the question is, can I force the neighbors to build a gate here? Does everyone agree that that is a good thing? And the Mishnah says in source number 9, the initial position in the Mishnah, did I say source 20? Source 20, the Mishnah says that you can coerce the neighbors to share in the cost of building a gatehouse and a gate for the joint courtyard. This is compulsory because it's obviously a good thing. It's a service that everybody needs, and we should therefore contribute to it.
Obviously a good thing.
This is the Mishnah says.
Issue in urban planning today.
The Mishnah says. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel disagrees. Okay, but then the Mishnah says, "What are you talking about?" Shoshana says, "This implies that the building of a gatehouse is a laudable thing." Wait a minute. That seems to imply that it's a good idea to build a gate here. And I know of a story. Okay, there was a case of a Hasid echad. That Eliyahu always used to come visit with him. And as soon as they built the gate, the Hasid didn't get visited by Eliyahu anymore. Okay, Eliyahu visited the Hasid because he was a tzaddik. He stopped visiting the Hasid because
he wasn't a tzaddik.
He wasn't a tzaddik anymore, which is crazy. Okay, so now Rashi tells you what's going on. Well, what? Look, this guy's a Hasid. He gives to everyone who's in need. Do you think he ever saw a deary in the brush that he didn't pull out of the river? Right? He was Batya every single time. He's a Hasid. But you have to hear Kine Nar Bochem. And once you built this, why did he build this? Because he wanted to be nice to his neighbors, because he wanted his kids to be able to leave their tricycles outside, because he didn't want vacuum cleaner salesmen knocking on his door. It wasn't because he wanted to keep out the poor people. It had nothing to do with keeping out the poor people. Of course, he always wanted to give tzedakah to the poor people when he saw them. But Nebuch, as soon as he built this gate, he couldn't hear the poor person. When he heard the poor person, he always responded, but he created a situation where he didn't hear the poor people. And that, says God, Rashi says, Lefisha mafsik ba'ani'im hatzoakim ve'ein kolam nishma. Because the gate is getting in between you and the poor people, and their voice couldn't be heard. And God is, I remind you, v'nitzak el Hashem elokei avoteinu, V'yishma Hashem ekolenu. What is God? V'yishma Hashem ekolenu. He hears tzaakatenu. God is the God that hears our cry. And what made Batya was that she heard the cry. And as soon as the Hasid put up a gate, he couldn't hear the cry. And so we have to build this wall. I'm not saying we shouldn't build the wall. We had to build the wall. It's Nebuch, but I think we have to understand the cost of building the wall. The cost of building the wall is twofold. It's not just, and this is where Miriam started right from the beginning of the class, really, is, gosh, there's a cost that we're keeping out the poor people, which is terrible. And there's another cost, which is what we've become, right? Mm-hmm. We've become the person that doesn't hear the cry. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, if we have to build this, how do we do it in a way that continues to hear the cry? Right, the meaning that we've done our fair share. We can't do everything, but that doesn't mean that we cease hearing the cry. We have to continue to try to get other people, I guess, to do their fair share. And it's not a solution to this problem in an hour and 15 minutes. But it's a little bit of beginning to think in Jewish terms. Next week we'll hit straight on Jewish, non-Jewish relations with the Arab citizens and Rav Shmuel, Shmuel Eliyahu's psak not to rent to non-Jews, and how can we respond to that? Thank you all very much for coming.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.